Welcome back, everyone. I am very pleased to introduce Babs Ryan to you. When I think of Babs, I think of financial services, I think of marketing, and I think of boards of directors. Babs is a board director for a $2.65 billion federal credit union. And I hope Babs will tell you a little bit. Can you all hear me? No?
Hey, feedback.
I'm getting a lot of interference.
All right. How about now?
No, it's people. We have to mute ourselves, I think, right? Now it's better, yeah. Okay. But yeah, I thought we had to mute ourselves.
Yeah, if you could mute yourself, that would be good. Babs is board director for an audit committee member for a $2.65 billion federal credit union. She's had a pile of patents. One is for a retail program that has generated $800 million in incremental retail sales. Her most recent patent is for a telehealth kids sports psychology coaching program. Babs was recently advisor to the Motorcycle Industry Council. She was chief innovation officer for GE Capital's largest division, with $24 billion in receivables. Their clients include Walmart, Gap, and Home Depot. Babs is currently serving as the board chair of GE Capital's new all-employee Six Sigma incubator. She has had profit and loss responsibility at Citibank, PwC, and she was also an ad agency CEO. So I'm very pleased to have her here. What we're going to do is we're going to go around the room, and I'm going to call on the different committees. The first committee is Brian, John, Marianne, Phil, and Stephen. Do you have a spokesperson?
Yes. Hi, Larry. It's Brian. I'll kind of kick things off, and hopefully if we get something wrong, my teammates will jump in. You know, with all of these cases, we never tend to have enough information, right? We wish we had more information. So we started with kind of a laundry list of, wow, I wish we knew. Financials would be nice. the background of those on the board, it really just reads of a good old boys network, but we really don't have an understanding of their substance capabilities, whether it be in strategy, M&A, going public, things of that nature. We really don't know how long the company's even been public, how the stock is doing. We don't have a really deep understanding even of their business model. And then the time of year, like given this, it looks like it's a potential cyclical business. And, you know, what time of year is this that they're in trouble or not in trouble? So we start there, but then we lead it into a kind of a working hypothesis. We glean from the case that, you know, they're kind of got some financial limitations. You know, the inability to restructure their finances, which led us to believe they're probably in a bit of trouble. And if that's truly the case, we would suggest that they take a serious look of merging with this company. But we would also recommend that they try and create competition. But because the board didn't appear to have depth on M&A and things of that nature, it might be harder to get others interested versus those that have come to the party. But our recommendation would be to seriously entertain that given the financial constraints. However, that may or may not come to fruition. So we can't rely on that solely. And so if a transaction is not doable, then what we really started to pursue is, okay, we probably need to do some type of a restructuring, both of the board members, possibly management, making sure that we're attracting and gaining people that have deeper experience in some of the areas that we suspect that they need help on, whether it be M&A, IPO, strategy. There weren't term limits that we could see. So again, I think that's something that should be thought through. The developing of a strategic plan, like, okay, so we get this talent, but as we get this talent, we really got to develop a plan. What should we do to avoid what just happened to us? So we talked a little bit about lessons learned too, like what would we do differently to avoid being in this situation in the future? So I think what we could have done differently to begin with is have the right talent on the board, really develop a long-term strategic plan, have term limits. But I think one of the things we also learned is, even if this M&A isn't possible, and even if we were to look to restructure the board or even management, we still need that cash infusion because that problem's not going away. So that may require us to seek, you know, other investors, angel, private equity, or otherwise. But because it's publicly traded, that may or may not be easily achieved, especially given the talent that we see lacking. So I guess to follow Babs' lead, you know, two questions. We would say probably pursue this M&A. And if that is not executable, then what we would think to do differently is restructure not just the board, but possibly leadership as well. Now, if I missed anything, you know, Marianne, John, Stephen, or Phil, please let me know or the group know.
You did great.
Good.
I just think one of the things we didn't talk about were some of the strategies that this company missed out on that they could have looked at. Do they sell to a larger motorcycle company? Do they go into something like rent a bike or a timeshare bike or something different? But no one's looked at any of those options either.
Thank you, Marianne. That's a good catch because that might be a way to give us some runway while we look to restructure and do some other things. So excellent point.
Thank you very much. Group two is Barry, Craig, Doug, and Robert. Do you have a spokesperson?
Yeah, it's Craig James here. I'll be handling it. And Robert had to leave early, so he sends his apologies. As everyone else said, there's obviously limited information in these things, but we go by what we have. The first thing was we recognize that this is a public company and there are outside forces acting on it. The impact of which is unknown. We thought that the board should meet to determine what it wants to achieve. Does it want to grow? Does it want to right the ship? Does it want to get out? And listen to the merger offer. It doesn't cost anything to listen and gather facts. We felt that it would be well to hire an advisor to help them determine really what the company is worth, given the current situation, financial situation, and potential future. One of us just recommended don't panic as board members, and then get some outside input, some impartial perspectives from someone who doesn't have any skin in the game, just an impartial person who can see things through a different lens. With respect to Dinah or Dina, whatever her name is, she's not irrelevant, but we felt that whatever that situation is, it's subordinate to the other considerations that we've just discussed here. So with respect to the question, should the Hog Heaven board vote in favor of the M&A? We just felt there wasn't enough information to vote one way or the other.
Yeah. Thank you.
Anybody else on the team want to add to that?
No. Okay. Thank you very much. Group three is Ed, Everett, Linda, and Vera.
So as a token hog owner, I drew the short straw of being the one to present to the group. And even shared a picture with the group of my wife and miniature dachshunds on the Road King Classic. So I think that we saw this as really being more of a management issue than a board issue. I mean, certainly there's a lot of board dynamics at play. And ultimately, the board is responsible for oversight of the management. But we didn't really connect the dots that quickly that this needs to be result in a board shakeup. We didn't feel like we had enough information. It felt more like what they need is responsible, experienced management, maybe some turnaround expertise, but folks that execute, know how to execute. Felt like that was the first place to start. Certainly, there's a number of things that we could point out about the board function, but we didn't really spend that much time going there. I think the reaction that we had, the answer to the ultimate question, should they accept the offer? We thought at this point, no, that they need to have somebody responsible managing the company and see what happens. There were certainly some other questions that we had along the way. How are other companies in a similar position in the marketplace handling this? It's interesting within our group, I think probably because of, you know, the experience that some have in this space and others don't have, there was even a question about whether this company is selling bikes or just selling aftermarket parts. I think we were split about half and half on that. Assuming that it's aftermarket parts and not the bikes, then we weren't clear why the saturation of used bikes in the market is a big problem, because somebody who's a second owner of a bike that they're spending 15 grand on might still be inclined to drop a couple grand on parts to trick it out and make it their own. So we didn't necessarily think that the market saturation was a problem the way that it was presented. We also thought we were, I think, probably not as dismissive of Dyna. It seemed that because her position in the industry, we don't know what her role is in that company, but presumably if she's on the board, she's in a responsible role within the exhaust manufacturing company. We thought that she might well have some insights that would inform a lot of the conversation, might have access to management candidates that we could look at and that sort of thing as well. Did I miss anything?
No, thank you. Thank you very much. The last group is Babs, Bob, Lara, and Suzanne. Do you have a spokesperson?
Can you hear me? Yes, that's me.
You're fine. Yep.
Super. Well, we thought it was interesting that we really needed the group to be taking a look at what's good for the stakeholders and not worried so much about how things look or, you know, what other board seats that people need. So we really decided that we needed to take a stakeholder approach to this, of course. And we also, it wasn't clear, as others have said, how bad the financials are at Hog Heaven. So what we did is we assumed that the financials were really bad and that this was more of a turnaround situation for the purposes of this exercise. And so given that we're in terrible financial decision, we really feel that it's incumbent upon us to consider a reasonable offer. We don't know if this is the right partner or not, this group that's come forward, but we did think we should at least as a board consider this. And we would consider this under the lens of, you know, what does that potential M&A group bring to the table to us besides much needed capital? You know, do they have market information that would be helpful and marketing expertise or sales and distribution strategy? Because we really, it felt, at least in the facts that we were given in the case, that it was a little strategy light at Hog Heaven. And we also talked about what is the board missing, because that's information that we would need to, you know, have presented to us in order to really make an informed decision here. This is a public company, so when there was this whole condition about you must hire the CEO and the chair, and they must be, you know, on your board, et cetera, that was a non-starter for us. And that would have to be negotiated. And then we also had questions about the private equity kingpin that was discussed in the case and whether that person's intentions were really to help us grow the business, because this is an adjacent business to that one, or are they just looking for a feather in their cap? We did say that if the financial situation was not as apocalyptic at Hog Heaven, that we would try and look at other levers. And I think other groups really did a good job talking about some of, you know, the other levers, including bringing in some outside, you know, consultant expertise to evaluate our position in the market, et cetera, would be a smart way to go.
Thank you very much. Well, now let me turn it over to Babs to comment on the comments that she's heard.
Am I on mute? The comments were great, and actually a lot of the suggestions that you made, I wish the board had thought of those at the time. One of the ones I heard that was great was why didn't they get an outside consultants to come in and help them? And unfortunately, it was after the fact that they did that, after it was over, when they were looking at what went wrong, that's when they actually decided to get people with an independent position. I should also add, Larry told me not to reveal that I was also the chief marketing officer of Kawasaki Motors in the UK. I had a company motorcycle, so part of my job was taking the press to Grand Prix circuits, and that is me riding around the Grand Prix circuit at Salzburgring in Austria going 150 miles an hour. I don't know if I'd do it now, but I did it then. So, and I was on the industry board as well in the UK to resolve regulatory issues and stuff. But what happened with this company, one, they never should have been a public company. And if you are invited to the board of a company that is in what I call a hobby industry, so that's sometimes boating, although that's a bigger industry, things like surfing, motorcycling, what you tend to have is a lot of people in management that aren't the top people in their functional areas and on the board that tend to be in, have a passion for those industries, but aren't necessarily the best board members. So you end up with, on a motorcycle board, all these motorcycle enthusiasts that know every wheel size and every part size, and they know, that's what they know, and the same in management. The comment that was made about they should have got, you know, it was a management issue. They should have got a CFO internally or somebody even as a consultant internally in management to help them with advising them with their financial problems. What ended up happening was they found out after they started doing a little more due diligence that Hot Rods and Pistons, this private equity firm, was also buying a bunch of other companies too. And the CEO simply wasn't ready to retire. I mean, this was every ounce of his breath. People in this industry, they live it. And it's also, if you're in customization, it's not just parts, it's an art. So each bike will be individualized. It won't just be put this mirror in that exhaust, they'll be personalized. So it's an art industry where the assets are not just the parts, they're actually the skills of the people who are doing the work. And they felt, they got concerned that their passion for what they did as artists would be destroyed by joining this, just being acquired. And obviously the private equity firm just wanted all the management out and wanted to take it over and make it more of an online business where we'll customize too. So they rejected the offer. But what happened after that is they realized they had a lot of financial problems. They had other issues and they really needed to make the boat right. So they ended up looking for someone else to acquire them. So while they weren't ready to take this offer because they weren't in the mindset to do it and they had too much passion about what they were still thinking of themselves as a little family business or, you know, a little community business. They did look for an M&A partner later on and they found somebody to acquire them and sell out who was in their industry of the art side of it and the customization that was larger. So there were, what were any other questions somebody wanted to ask me?
How bad was their situation?
Their situation wasn't that bad, but it was going to get worse because most people customize when they buy a new bike. And I think it was Marianne that said, and some other people said, why don't they think about other things to do? So they should have been marketing to get people to customize their existing bikes, right? They could have done a big marketing push, but they weren't really marketing experts. They were motorcycle experts. So they should have done that, but they didn't. So it was going to get worse. because they were going through a period, like I use this example now, but the period they were in was very similar. The market was going to collapse. And there was no way in the situation I put, they could have predicted it, because no one knew COVID was coming and no one knew the motorcycle market was going to go through the roof. People were going to buy motorcycles they weren't going to use. They were going to sit in garages, and then the resale value would be nothing. So, you know, there'd be a glut. So they couldn't have predicted it, but they should have had marketing skills too.
How about Dina? Was she a potentially overlooked asset, or was she inappropriately on the board?
She was an asset because she worked for the biggest exhaust company in the business. And so the number, I mean, I didn't go into the weeds on this, but actually exhausts are the number one thing Harley drivers change over when they buy a motorcycle. As you probably know, Ed, the number one thing they do is put on an illegal exhaust so it's noisy. And and they can be heard and seen when they're coming. That's what they claim. But she would have been an asset, and I don't think they leveraged her enough, because they just looked at her as, we got to fill this with a diverse candidate. And this woman had incredible knowledge of the industry and sales and could have helped them because she knew who the buyers were. Yeah, good idea. These were good ideas. I wish you were all there when they went through this, because it would have helped him a lot. Any other
questions? Listening to you, I was reminded of... In the 1990s, I was working for a well-known, highly regarded manufacturer of sports bicycles. And it was the same dynamics. All of the people in management were really into sports bikes. And they were passionate about it, but they weren't very businesslike. And eventually, it got acquired. And it's an old story.
And they don't leave. The other thing is, people in these types of industries, they have very long tenure because there's a small number of competitors and they just move from one to the other. So there's not a lot of new blood that comes into these industries, which is why often they fail to keep scaling or growing in market size. So just know, if you're going to join a board like this, it can be really challenging, because the skills, the functional skills of the people are often, and the tenure of people, you know, they've been there forever, so they might not know the latest technology or the latest marketing, because they don't want to ever leave, because they play with bikes all day. I mean, that's all I did all day. I played with motorcycles and ATVs and jet skis. That was my day.
So Babs, you talk like an outsider until that last comment there, but so how did you get involved, and how did they treat you as an outsider?
So it was a bit, so my first role, I was first in the industry and then I was on the board. It's actually surprising. At the time I was there, I was, I think, the only woman in the C-suite, maybe other than an HR person. And I was certainly, I'm pretty sure I was Kawasaki's first C-suite person in the world, probably at that level. The Preston care and the local market didn't care, because after the first week, and they grilled me on damping systems and braking systems, and they knew I knew my stuff, they didn't care anymore. And the passion for the product is so strong that if you're sitting in a room and talking about the product, you're good. You're part of the insiders. And it's the same with the boards in those industries. They love bikes, so they're talking about bikes at all the meetings, and then they do business. So you're accepted if you know the product, which becomes a problem, because sometimes the people they need on the board is not somebody who knows the product. It's somebody who knows something that they don't.
Any other questions or comments?
Larry, I've got one.
Yeah. Go ahead.
So I don't know if everybody saw her picture that she sent around on the chat.
Yeah.
No.
It's right there on the chat group. But when I saw that, Larry, I thought of something. I don't normally say this phrase, but it was "you go, girl." You know, that's not normally my language.
Yeah. I'm good with it.
A big number.
Yeah, it's a protected environment, right? You're supposed to do that on a racetrack. You're not, you know, I was a safety girl too. I was actually the first person in the industry that instituted free motorcycle training with every single motorcycle we sold. I started that because I wanted people to live and look out for cars. So everybody on the call, please look twice for a motorcyclist. We see them, they don't register. Please look twice. You can save a life by looking twice.
Any other comments, questions, or issues that this case might raise for you?
First comment I have is that Babs is like the Mona Lisa Vitti of, if you remember from My Cousin Vinny, you were the female executive who they had no expectations from, and all of a sudden you were the top expert in the room. You know, aside from that, I think that this is a very interesting case because it goes back to the what happens with the founder, owner, manager, 100%, you know, owner almost of something that you can just only take it so far. And, you know, the fact that it happens to be in this very exotic industry, you know, only makes it more interesting. But this thing spills out into so many companies that have that characteristic, you know, the founder, owner, I know better than anybody else, you know, about what this business is about.
Yeah.
I was really fascinated by the, this whole hobby aspect, because some of our clients, with our, acoustical business, are in the studio, music studio business. And well, what we find,
people may not know what your business is. Would you explain a little bit about what your business is?
Oh, I'd be happy to. So, my husband and I, manufacture a, patented soundproofing device that goes every square foot or so in walls or four ceilings to decouple the surface and keep noise from translating through those surfaces. So it's a soundproofing device and typically used in a lot in music studios and a lot in multifamily housing. And we find that we're dealing with a lot of niche companies, and they're the one in the music industry. And I'm thinking this is the same sort of thing. They're all passionate about the music and the stereo systems and the recording and the all of that. But it's brutal getting them to, you know, pay a bill or give you a proper purchase order, or, you know, so I got a kick out of hearing about that from that aspect as well.
One thing that this case reminded me of is that I've been in a number of small companies where you have one controlling shareholder who actually. So it's a more of an advisory nature than the board really, you know, being in control necessarily. But it behooves everybody to sort of know, to be open, or for the, even for in this case, Axel to be open, you know, and say, you know, if we make any things, it may affect who's on the board, it may affect a lot of things. So let's make sure that whatever we decide we're doing, if we decide we're going to look for an acquirer, or if we just decide we're going to try to grow the company or both, that we add some incentives so everybody is on, you know, is motivated. Because that can sometimes be in situations where people are just hanging on to board seats just for the hell of it. And the same thing. One's legal counsel, and one's accountants, outside accountants. You know, when there's mergers, somebody usually loses in those things, and just to be aware of those and conscious of those, so the board can do its best job to sort of do the right thing.
Babs, how did they actually get to, we raised this with a small group, how did they actually get to be public? Did they buy a corporate shell? Did they go through the process, all of the due diligence and dog and pony shows and whatever to raise money? Because that also has an implication. And did they actually enjoy the public status or not? I mean, because, you know, there's a lot of disadvantages to being a public company when you're this kind of company, especially.
You're blocked, Babs.
It was a shell arrangement and they never should have done it. Like all the regulatory reporting and all the things they had to do, he really wanted to run it like a private company. It was really the CEO. The other board members were fillers, except for his buddy Axel, his buddy Fatboyne. And they never should have done it. It's too much work being a public company for a company that size. And that was one of the regrets they actually had, is that they ever did that, because it just made everything more difficult. So, you know, people think, oh, I'm a public company, you know, and sometimes there's ego attached to it.
We've all been there, done that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Any other issues with this case? I'd like to turn the conversation a little bit, because before we started the seat at the table this evening, I was talking with Babs about her role as a member of a board of a co-op bank. And she happened to mention something about that her bank had insurance that if you have deposits over $250,000, that insurance would cover it. I had no idea that there was that kind of insurance. And I haven't seen too many banks publicize that. You want to comment on that, Babs? Because I'm sure that there are a number of people here who have deposits in banks.
Yes, and I should actually know this. I'm actually going to pull up where they get the insurance from. So with banks, your deposits are FDIC insured up to $250,000. And then most banks don't insure you after that amount. With a credit union, their first $250,000 is insured by their regulatory body, which is the NCUA. The credit union I'm on the board of, long ago, before I was even on the board, they decided they wanted to fully protect their members long before COVID, long before, you know, 2008, whatever. And they, I will tell you where they get their extra insurance from, because they're very proud of that. It's the MSIC. So the MSIC actually insures their all deposits for, it's a massive amount. I think it's all of them over $250,000. So anybody, you know, I would love you all to be deposit customers at Workers Credit Union in the United States at one of our branches. It's a wonderful place. And seriously, they cover all your deposits. So you are covered if anything happens. And of course, we are sound, so I don't have concerns about that anyway.
Not to pitch competition to Babs, but there's also a group in Massachusetts under the Depositors Insurance Fund, who can be the commercial bank for a company anywhere in the U.S., perhaps globally, I'm not sure, but anywhere in the U.S., that offers complete insurance of all commercial, maybe perhaps personal deposits as well. So that's another option.
Is that a specific bank or is that an organization?
No, I dropped the link in chat. It's a consortium, I believe, of Massachusetts banks.
Okay. That's good to know. In the time we have remaining, is there any kind of issue that, you know, we have a bunch of very smart, sophisticated, and experienced business people here. Anybody need any help, ideas, thoughts, networking that anybody here can help anybody with? Not hearing anything, then we will conclude for this evening. And I want to thank Babs very much for writing the case and for managing the discussion about the case. We will see you next month at this time, and you'll be hearing from us about next month. So
you have a date. Do you have a date for the next month?
Yeah, we usually do it the last Thursday of the month. So the next program is going to be May 25th at from 5 to 6:30, May 25th. Okay.
Thank you. Great.
Thank you. Nice meeting everybody. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.